Radio. Eclectic athlete. Eclectic athlete radio. Welcome everyone to another episode of Eclectic Athlete Radio. I'm your host, Jules DeMay. If you're a new listener, thank you and welcome. And if you are a continuing listener, welcome back. I know it's been a while, and I know I say that at the beginning of every episode. My last episode is probably November. But again, grad school, life caught up with me. And as we all know, we're in the midst of this pandemic, which has been on the minds of pretty much everyone. Some people going stir crazy, some people getting restless. But again, if I could describe this podcast in one word, it would be optimize. How do we optimize the situation that we're in? We can't always change our environment or our circumstances, but we can make the most out of it. And again, for me, it's not about just doing things half-assed or at 50%. How do we optimize it? How do we get the most out of it? So that's the information I want to bring you today. How do we make the most out of the situation? How do we optimize our health and our performance even when we're limited? So to start off, we're going to talk about several different factors. Again, a lot of people talk about these. They're sort of cliche, but mastering the basics is so important, especially in these times. Now, what I want to bring you today is information that might not be available to most, or just unconventional information. That's a little bit about what Eclectic Athlete is about, giving you information on both sides of the coin and trying to expand your knowledge, basically. So first things first, let's talk about sleep. Okay, sleep. It's so crucial to optimizing your health and your immune system. Again, that's what this episode is mostly about. And also give you some tidbits on how to optimize your performance. So if you're an avid gym goer, if you're an athlete, this will also help you out. But sleep, it's so important. It prevents pro-inflammatory compounds such as cytokines to be released. When we don't get adequate sleep, those are increased, and they also lead to things like grogginess, lack of energy, and inability to control our hunger. Different hormones are affected, such as ghrelin. Ghrelin is one of our satiety hormones, and leptin as well. So when these are out of whack, you might have noticed after a night of bad sleep, you're not able to control what you want to eat or control your cravings as much. Melatonin is a powerful antioxidant, and melatonin is a hormone or a chemical that really regulates our sleep and our circadian rhythm. That's another term I'll be referencing here on out. Melatonin starts to be secreted during the evening and throughout the night. When it's disrupted, it can lead to insomnia, lack of sleep, and lack of quality sleep. Now, in a perfect world, our melatonin would be at optimal levels, obviously, but in modern society, melatonin is usually disrupted in ways that we don't even realize. Blue light, so light that comes from our phones, our televisions, LED lights, computer screens, they inhibit melatonin release. So that's important to realize, that if we're up late, if we're on our phones, if we're scrolling through Instagram at night, this is disrupting our circadian rhythm or our body's internal clock. Okay. Now, another thing that disrupts melatonin, actually this is more new research, is eating. So when we eat actually has a big effect on our internal clock. So our liver has tons of different genes, different proteins, and it releases different hormones. When we eat, our liver proteins are activated. And on top of that, when we eat at night, this also disrupts our insulin release. So insulin deals with blood sugar. When we have an increase in blood sugar, insulin is released, brings it into our cells. And again, insulin disrupts melatonin release. So it's not, again, It's not just about what you eat. It's about when you eat and what you're eating. Okay. And at the same time, this goes into intermittent fasting a little bit. So it's been a more of a trend lately, skipping certain meals or eating within a restricted feeding window. And I'm actually a big proponent of that. But at the same time, we have to kind of control our windows. So if you're eating your first meal at noon and your last meal is at, you know, 9 or 10 p.m., even though that feeding window is smaller, again, you're disrupting your sleeping pattern. So people go back and forth on, you know, is breakfast important or not? Again, it's not necessarily about the, you know, breakfast in and of itself, but we have to know that feeding or eating activates those liver genes, and it tells us that, hey, it's time to wake up. Now, another aspect that tells our body to wake up and is really important for sleep is light. More natural light during the day, especially in the morning, is a really important cue for sleep later on at night. And actually, some research has been showing that if you have sleep issues, even if you have, you know, a lack of sleep, having more natural daylight can offset some of that. And at the same time, being exposed to blue light, the more exposure you have to blue light can be offset by how much natural sunlight you have. So that's pretty key, because we usually do the opposite, right? We're exposed to a lot of blue light and very little natural sunlight. So go out, get 10-15 minutes of sunlight in the morning, without sunglasses, without sunscreen, because our receptors in our eyes and on our skin are very important, and we don't really want to block that out. Obviously, you don't want to be in the sun for too long, but we need that natural exposure. And it's also really important for vitamin D. So vitamin D production is increased with sunlight. And as we'll talk about next, well, in a little while, vitamin D is really important for our immune system. Now, the last thing I'll talk about with light is red light therapy. So in the morning, usually I'll use my red light. It's called a Juve. This is kind of a portable light system, which has a combination of visible and invisible red and infrared light. So these are mimicking the effects of the sun. If you live in an area where there's not a lot of sun exposure or a lot of sunlight throughout the day, it would be a worthy investment to get one of these infrared or red lights. But a simple hack, again, is just switching your light bulbs into, you know, incandescent or just warmer lights, so more orange and red type of lights, especially at night, as opposed to those LEDs, which are really high in blue light. Now, moving on to nutrition. So the first thing I'll talk about is, what are our diets missing? Okay, we always talk about, you know, boosting our immune system through greens, right? Vitamin C, and that's great. You know, foods like grapefruits, lemons, limes, kiwis, broccoli sprouts, all these types of foods are really rich in vitamin C and other compounds, which are awesome. But I think at the same time, the American diet, standard American diet, is missing a lot of traditional and ancestral foods that are still consumed widely in other parts of the world. So I'll start with foods that are easily implemented and then gradually go into foods that may not be as known but have the most benefit. So the first is fermented foods. Okay, so these are prebiotics and probiotics. I'm sure you've heard of these before. Prebiotics feed our gut bacteria. And one thing that's important to know is that our immune system is highly linked to our gut bacteria. Okay, we have trillions of gut bacteria, more than any other cell in our body. And these protect our gut. We have a lining in our gut, and when the lining is broken down, think of it like a fence. The more spaces there are in between each picket or between each post, the more different things like pathogens and other inflammatory compounds can get into our bloodstream and affect our immune system. That's what causes inflammatory reactions. These different compounds get in and our body attacks them, which in turn we feel different symptoms that are not the best, like indigestion, bloating, you know, chronic disease and inflammation, etc. So prebiotics feed our gut bacteria. And these are foods like unripe bananas, dandelion root, chicory root, jicama is one of my favorites, as well as, I believe, resistant starches. So rice that is cooled down, heated and then cooled down, can also act as a prebiotic, I believe. Now, probiotics are actual foods with gut, with bacteria in them. So you want live strains. A lot of companies sell supplements that are probiotics, but the efficacy of these supplements is contradictory at times. Some might even report that, or some studies report that these strains don't even make it alive into your gut, right? We have to go through our stomach, which is highly acidic. So the even if there are live strains, a lot of them don't make it. So in my opinion, it's better to get it from foods. So foods that are fermented, fermented vegetables are extremely high in probiotics, as well as fermented dairy. So kefir is one of my favorite dairy sources. I try to get raw kefir, which has even more beneficial strains and good probiotics. Kimchi, sauerkraut, natto. Natto is pretty much the only soy that I actually haven't tried it, but it's fermented soy. So I don't really recommend soybeans or tofu or anything like that, especially if you get it in the US. Not the greatest sources, but fermented soy like natto, which is very popular in Japan, I believe, is a great source. Apple cider vinegar and kombucha, all really awesome sources of probiotics. Kombucha, the only thing you want to watch out for is high sugar content, right? And the next food, or food, I guess is a more so a beverage, that is not really consumed in the US. Lately, it has been trending again, is bone broth. Again, nowadays you see all types of bone broth proteins, different companies making their own bone broths, which is great. But you can make your own if you have the time and if you care to know what exactly is in your product or in your in what you're consuming. And actually, right now I'm making my own bone broth. I am using beef brisket bones, pig's feet, and I chopped up some celery, some carrots, threw some apple cider vinegar in there, and some spices. I know, you hear the word pig's feet and it kind of makes you, kind of irks you a little bit, but again, this goes back to what is considered normal in the standard American diet. We are pretty obsessed with muscle meats, you know, chicken breasts, ribs, burgers, things like that, steaks, but all these other parts of the animal, in my opinion, is the best way to really honor the life of the animal and get the most nutrients, because different parts of the animal have different nutrients in them. So the bones, bone marrow, has a lot of different trace minerals that are really important for the gut and for health in general. So bone broth is one of my favorite sources. I drink it at night usually, and actually before training. So this applies for both health and performance. Dr. Keith Barr over at UC Davis has done a lot of research on gelatin and combining it with vitamin C 50 minutes to an hour prior to exercise can help regenerate connective tissue. So if you have joint pain, if you've had any ligament or tendon issues, this it would behoove you to start taking it, right, daily if you can. And again, this is where more so of a collagen protein powder would come into play, because you'd probably run out of the bone broth pretty quick. But I'll usually do a bone broth powder before training, and then I'll do my bone broth at night. And again, one of the reasons why bone broth is so beneficial is the amino acid content. So it has a amino acid called glycine, which is linked to gut health, and it also helps you helps facilitate sleep even more. So again, another reason to take it at night. And overall, again, lots of minerals, very anti-inflammatory, really great for your joints. All right, moving along, the next food category that is highly underutilized are herbs and spices. And again, these are, I mean, so easy to utilize and implement into your diet. Turmeric, cumin, thyme, oregano. All these are staples in my pantry. And I pretty much, I mean, you can just sprinkle them on any dish that you're making. Again, I put them in my bone broth whenever I make, you know, any type of beef, ground beef or anything like that, toss them in there. And thyme actually is a particularly useful spice or herb if you eat a lot of meat. So, you know, certain studies have shown different compounds are created when you heat meat to a high temperature. And thyme actually can prevent the production of these. So again, you just sprinkle it on. You can get the whole leaf. I just have it in a chopped up form where I just sprinkle it on to whatever dish I'm making. And then I also try not to heat my meats to too high of a temperatures. I usually use my air fryer, which prevents a lot of smoking, or I'll slow cook it. So those are other strategies. Now, moving on to my favorite and usually the most jaw-dropping or eye-opening food group are organ meats. So kidneys, liver, heart. Again, a lot of people, you might, you know, kind of wince at the thought of eating these meats. I was the same when I first did. Liver was probably the first organ meat I tried. I would not start out with liver. It has a very distinct taste. But once you get used to it, very, very delicious, depending on how you prepare it. Kidney and heart are slightly less distinct tasting. They don't taste as much like organ meats. So I would do a combination of those. And actually, a company that I use called nosetotail.org sells combinations. So it's pretty much ground beef combined with other organ meats like kidney, spleen, heart, liver, and you cannot even taste it. But I prefer to just buy those organs myself. I'll cut them up, chop them up, mix it with some ground beef and eat it like that. Again, I'll know exactly what the content is in my product or what I'm consuming. But the reason why they're so beneficial, I mean, these are literally the most nutrient-dense foods that you can find on Earth. Vitamin A, the highest content, CoQ10. So a lot of people talk about the antioxidant compounds or content of plant and fruits, but we can actually produce our own antioxidants. Like I said, melatonin is an antioxidant, glutathione, CoQ10 is one of them, and organ meats such as heart are very high in CoQ10 as well. Vitamin B12, a lot of people are deficient in B vitamins, and these are so important for various metabolic processes. I believe liver is one of the highest sources of vitamin B12. I mean, it's like 1,000% of the RDA, which isn't an issue, by the way, because it's water soluble. So you use what you need and you pretty much pee out the rest. Vitamin B3, B6, also very important, and other trace minerals like zinc, selenium, etc. Now, going off of that, zinc and selenium are two very important nutrients that are also linked to our immune system. So again, organ meats, you pretty much get all you need. Now, I did a little carnivore experiment the month of January. I meant to do a podcast after that, but again, life got crazy. Yeah, it's exactly what it sounds like. I ate not only meat, but only animal products for the entire month. No fruits, no vegetables, anything like that. And I actually felt great. I had tons of energy. I did a little bit of fasting and I did not have any cravings. Again, I lost, you know, like 4% body fat, gained some muscle. It was overall a good experience. The reason I stopped was, I mean, I didn't miss vegetables, but I did miss other foods like nuts and certain fruits, I guess. So it was a little restrictive. I'm not an advocate of restrictive diets. I basically did some blood work before and after, and I was trying to compare my metrics to see, you know, what works. Because again, what works for one person works differently for someone else. So it's just a little experiment. I don't advocate anyone go do that, especially right now. But it just goes to show you how important animal foods are in our diet and how they provide complementary nutrients to plant foods. So moving on, other important foods that you can include, salmon, which is really high in DHA and EPA. These are important for cognitive health, anti-inflammation. They're high in calcium, astaxanthin, which is a really unique antioxidant. Eggs, I mean, I eat 2 to 3 a day. So many nutrients in eggs, really important for brain health and a lot of other nutrients in them. And of course, some less talked about foods, garlic, onions, and ginger. They have tons of anti-inflammatory properties. They aid in digestion. Garlic and onions are also prebiotic foods. So again, really easy to implement. I just chop some up, throw them in with my meat, and I'm good to go. And some extra foods here, your healthy fats. Always, we don't want to forget those. Grass-fed butter, ghee, extra virgin olive oil has omega-9s and polyphenols. Avocados have vitamin E, fiber. The combination of these, again, increases microbial diversity, which we want. And again, they all have unique properties. So I have a rotation. Basically, I use ghee one day, coconut oil one day, I have duck fat, etc. And I always drizzle some extra virgin olive oil on my salads. Now, the one thing with olive oil is that a lot of olive oil is actually mixed with canola oil or other seed oil. So you want to watch out for that. A simple test is put it in your fridge and it should harden up a little bit. It should get a little cloudy, I believe. And now the last food group, I mean, this is kind of an extra, mushrooms. So maitake, shiitake, turkey tail mushrooms are really great for immune health. Reishi mushrooms and chaga are great for mood and calming effects. I try to use some of these daily. I use a company called Four Sigmatic, which does different mushroom blends. They have mushroom coffee, and they have one called the Lion's Mane, which is great for cognitive support. I actually just had my coffee right now with a mix of lion's mane and chaga. Keep me nice and stable, nice and calm during this podcast. Get the thoughts out of my head. So those are some extras. But again, combination of all of these different nutrients, all these different foods are key to support your immune system and support your health and support your performance. So whether that's work performance or athletic performance, cutting out any food group does have ramifications. I've been reading this book called The Edge Effect. Talks about neurotransmitters and how, you know, we all have a balance of dopamine, serotonin, GABA, and acetylcholine, and all these act in different ways on our brain, right? And different foods affect these neurotransmitter balances. Lack of certain foods can result in deficiencies. So again, you know, we can be ideological about what foods are good or bad, quote unquote, but you know, our body doesn't care, okay? All it knows is, are you getting the right nutrients or not? So moving on, let's talk about exercise. Yes, okay, that's my forte here. So, but I want to talk about a little bit about the research, okay? If you guys know me, hopefully you do. If you're listening to this podcast, you know that I'm a health enthusiast. Again, I'm trying to optimize my performance, especially in these times. I don't have a lot of, I guess relative to other people, I have a lot of equipment, but I don't have any barbells. I don't have a squat rack in my home. But I've still been able to get really effective exercise. So that's why I'm gonna give you guys, I'll be giving you guys some tips on how to optimize your performance, even just using your body weight. But first, I wanna talk about the health side. In a recent post, I talked about what it means to be healthy. And I think a lot of people think they're healthy, but don't really know, right? They just have the assumption that they're healthy. And this assumption comes from the idea that being healthy is having a lack of disease. In my opinion, by that metric, a lot of people are healthy. But in my opinion, that's setting the bar really low. Just because you don't have a disease doesn't mean you're healthy, okay? So what if you're on the verge of developing the disease, right? Are you still healthy? And what I'm talking about here exactly is the metabolic syndrome. And this is a great simple measurement or a combination of different measurements to ascertain quantitatively whether or not you're healthy. And again, this is just a baseline. And basically what I'm saying is, in English, it objectively tells you, are you on the right path to being healthy or not? Okay, so it's a combination of five different measurements. High or low fasting blood sugar. If you have high fasting blood sugar, that's indicative of you having either pre-diabetes or on your way to having diabetes. High resting blood pressure indicates hypertension, high triglycerides. So just like glucose, if we're not metabolizing it correctly, it's going to be high in our blood. If we have high triglycerides, it's the same thing, but for our fat. This is also indicative of a metabolic dysfunction. Low HDL, so that's our quote-unquote good cholesterol. Having low HDL, I believe for men it's 40 and for women it's 50. I might have switched them around, but essentially you want the higher the better. LDL, it's a little bit more controversial. I wouldn't get into that, but again, you want a high HDL. Obesity, if you have a high waist circumference, I believe for men it's 40 inches and for women 35 inches. So if you are at that marker or above, you might be overweight or on your way to obesity. Now, all these metrics are not meant to make anyone feel bad. It's not meant to disparage anyone. It's just information. It's to inform you on what you can do to better your health and are you on the right track to being healthy. And I think especially in these times, you know, a lot of people think that, you know, health is personal. You know, whose business is it if I'm healthy or not? And the fact of the matter is, with this pandemic, it's everyone's business if you're healthy. Because if you're not healthy, that makes you, well, let's think about it this way. If you're unhealthy and you get coronavirus, if you pass away due to coronavirus or some of these underlying factors, and actually we've been seeing that people passing away from coronavirus have had underlying conditions. If you pass away, you know, that doesn't just affect you. Obviously, it affects your family, it affects those who know you. At the same time, if you are unhealthy, it can affect others. I'm not sure about the transmission rate, but again, it does have a mental effect as well. So as a society, we need to really take a proactive approach, and that's all I'm trying to get at. We need to take a proactive approach in being healthy. So although I do believe in, you know, not restricting yourself, there is a little bit of restriction that we need. You know, you can't just eat Cheetos and drink soda every day. Again, it's not just about weight loss or physique or aesthetics. It's about health. And in America, we are, you know, we have not only this pandemic going on, we have an epidemic of obesity and diabetes and chronic disease. So we really need to step it up. Now, I just introduced that again. If you have three of those five metrics, you are considered to have metabolic syndrome. Now, if you have those, it's not the end of the world. You can actually reverse that through different things like lifestyle, nutrition, and of course, exercise interventions. And actually, a meta-analysis just came out in 2020, which basically is a review of several different studies. And it's the consequences of physical inactivity in older adults. And the reason I bring this up is, you know, while we're young, we're more, you know, more likely to exercise. But I think a lot of people retire and they think, you know, I'm old, I don't need to exercise. No, exercise is a lifetime thing. It's not an option. People think that it's, you know, it's an optional thing. It's how we became human, how we survived, how we evolved. It's part of the human experience. But again, with modern society, it has led us to being sedentary, which is obviously has become an issue with epidemic of all these other illnesses. But the result of the study essentially said that physically active older adults, those who are 60 and above, were at a reduced risk of all-cause and cardiovascular mortality. So breast and prostate cancer, fractures, recurrent falls, functional limitations, Alzheimer's, dementia. So you see all these different factors are affected by exercise. Exercise can boost brain activity, potentially stave away cognitive decline. It can boost bone density, so can reduce incidence of fractures. improves your strength, your muscle mass. We know as we age, a lot of people don't die from old age per se. They die from things like falling down and not being able to get up, or falling down, breaking their hip, and not being able to recover from the surgery. So again, it's important that we start exercise now, start these habits now, so that they continue into our old age and that we benefit in our old age. Now, another paper talked about obesity as a predictor for mortality from coronavirus. So there's been a big correlation between the two, and again, other factors such as diabetes. I believe that's the second factor. And which is interesting because I read a different paper which talked about differences in all-cause mortality between obese people who are fit and obese people who are unfit. And it sounds kind of like an oxymoron. Essentially, that just means obese people who exercise and obese people who are sedentary. And the obese people who were active and engaged in exercise actually had a significant reduction in all-cause mortality, as opposed to the obese people who were not exercising. So again, even though you might have some sort of chronic condition, some sort of metabolic dysfunction, that does not excuse you from, well, first of all, it doesn't condemn you to living like that for your whole life. And at the same time, you know, it's on you. It's on you to make that change. And again, there's tons of different resources out there. I'm not saying it's easy, and I'm definitely not trying to blame these people. And actually, I blame society. Again, our modern society just heavily relies on things like aesthetics, superficiality, which makes weight loss seem like a superficial goal. But again, really, there's so many benefits to maintaining a healthy weight. And obviously, exercising can help with that, in addition to nutrition. Now, let me give you some tips here. I'm going to talk about some advice that I've taken myself for optimizing your training with minimal weights. Okay, so all this information has been great. How do we apply it? Okay. First of all, it depends on how many days a week you're going to exercise. I would say right now, you should be exercising every day. And this doesn't mean high intensity exercise. It means go for a 10 to 20 to 30 minute walk at minimum every day, okay? And this is just a baseline. Again, you can kind of couple this with getting sunlight. So there's a twofold benefit there. Now, number two, if you are trying to build muscle, I would say, especially with less weight, training each muscle group to failure twice a week would be beneficial. You don't need to get super advanced. For example, for your chest, doing push-ups to failure, you know, a couple sets, as many as you can. If you can't do push-ups, you can go onto an elevated surface. So go onto a table, go onto a chair. Again, try to keep your form right. And you can also make it harder. So you can do a drop set, which is essentially going to a lighter weight, quote unquote, after you reach that failure point in that first set. So for example, if you can do push-ups, great. Do your set of push-ups on the ground and then elevate your feet, do push-ups that way. Or you can do it the opposite way, depending on which is harder for you. So with your feet elevated, it is a little bit harder. So I would actually do that first and then do your push-ups on the ground. And then you could do, you know, another drop set, do tricep push-ups. So bring your hands in closer, do another set. So I've been utilizing that method, training to failure. And this goes into metabolic stress. Okay, so metabolic stress, you know, weights are not magical. You can get an effect as long as you train intelligently. But all that weights do is they have an added intensity. They bring an added intensity into your training. So intensity specifically means the percentage of your one rep max. Okay, that's all it means. If you do a body weight squat, obviously that's like, I don't know, 5% of your one rep max. Whereas if you squatted with, your body weight on your back, it might be a lot higher. Well, it will be a lot higher. So that's just a concept there. And that's more mechanical stress. How much weight are you adding? You can also increase your mechanical stress through leverages. So let's say instead of doing a body weight squat on 2 feet, pick 1 foot up. Now do your squat way harder, right? You can do 20 to 30 body weight squats without, you know, breaking a sweat. Try doing that with one leg lifted off the ground and try to reach that same depth. So that mechanical stress is a lot higher, which is closer to that effect of the weights. The intensity is higher. So that's metabolic stress, right? What is the effect? How many repetitions are you doing? The higher repetitions that you do, the more metabolic stress that is created. How much weight are you using? That's more mechanical stress. And so we want to combine these things, okay? And you can also use things like increase the time under tension. So instead of just doing a squat up and down as fast as you can, do it as slow as you can. Go 10 seconds on the way down, explode up, okay? That's utilizing the eccentric portion or emphasizing the eccentric portion of the lift. And then the concentric, where you stand up, is explosive. So you're trying to recruit different muscle fibers and motor units. But that slow lengthening, even with body weight, can increase that tension, which increases the physiological or that metabolic stress. Isometrics are another great tool to use. You can pause at the bottom of your squat, you know, do 5 to 10 seconds of a pause. People have done extended ISOs, or what's called extreme ISOs, you know, holding the bottom of a position for minutes on end. And that's a little bit more advanced, a little bit more intense, but you get the idea. Different ways to modify your training. And some of the hacks I've been using have been blood flow restriction training. So using a band, or you can use wrist wraps. I use actual blood flow restriction straps. I attach them to my shoulder areas and to my thigh areas. What that does, that increases that metabolic or physiological stress. It decreases the venous blood flow that is coming back to be oxygenated. Okay. It's not restricting my arterial blood flow. That's really important. So you don't want to have it too tight. But what that does is, you know, when we exercise, that burning feeling, that burning sensation, lactic acid, hydrogen ions, the acidity in your muscles is increasing. There's other things like inorganic phosphates, etc. These things build up. In a normal state, our body can, with normal blood flow, our body, you know, takes it into the muscle or takes it from the muscle, reoxygenates it. You get new blood, fresh blood, and that's how you continue exercise. Once you reach that failure point, however, that's when those things are building up. Particularly lactic acid, I believe, prevents you from continuing. It could also be the hydrogen ions. Now, with blood flow restriction, essentially that failure point goes down a lot, and particularly referring to the intensity. So if you could do, let's say, a squat with 200 pounds on your back, and you could do 10 reps. That means your one rep max is probably, let's say, 350, for example. With blood flow restriction, you can get the same effect in terms of hypertrophy, at least, with using, let's say, 50 pounds, right? So it's usually 20 to 30% of your one rep max can still elicit a hypertrophic response. I don't know what the math is on those numbers, but essentially 20-30%, which is a lot lighter than your one rep max, you can still get a training effect from it. And the protocol I use for that is one set of 30, followed by 3 sets of 15, 30 to 45 seconds in between each set. And that's just one exercise, usually a single joint exercise. So for chest, I'll do like banded flies, bicep curls. You can do, you know, split squats or squats for your legs, etc. And so that's one of the hacks I've been using. A lot of research on it, by the way, and I'm actually writing a big paper on it. In the future, well, hopefully in a few weeks here, I'll do a review on the blood flow restriction bands that I use. Again, these can be a little bit more costly, so you can use some elastic wraps or wrist wraps. That's what I used to use in the past. Again, you want to make sure that you're controlling that pressure. You don't want to have it too tight. You know, if your hands are going numb, definitely way too tight. If you are losing color in your hands, definitely way too tight. Another thing I've been utilizing is electrical stimulation. So I use a unit called the PowerDot 2.0, and it's controlled by Bluetooth connected to my phone. I can run several different programs on it. So most people are used to electrical stimulation in a rehab setting, physical therapy. People have used TENS units, which is more for pain. And you can also use that with this unit. You can use it for recovery, so it has more of a muscle pumping action. So it sends an electrical stimulus to your muscle, which makes it contract. Basically makes it contract and relax. And again, that pumps blood flow in and out of that muscle, which helps with recovery. Now, the way I've been using it, in addition to the recovery protocol, has been for strength or power stimulation. So the program has specific algorithms of intensity and contractions that stimulate those muscle fibers. And we want to activate motor units. So motor unit is, think about it like you put your hand on a table and whatever it touches, it activates. So similarly, a motor unit is like a control center, and it controls different fibers and muscles. So our muscle fibers, as they contract, they produce force. So again, if we're just using body weight, it's hard to activate all our motor units. As we get closer and closer to failure, we will activate more and more. There are lower threshold motor units, which are activated with low intensity exercise, and higher threshold motor units, which are activated with high intensity exercise. As we get closer to failure, we are activating those, but that's only if you're getting to true failure, and it takes, it's definitely a battle to get to that. You have to push yourself, and if you don't have anyone to hold you accountable, again, using the electrical stimulation is another great way to really maximize that hypertrophic, that strength response, and activating all those muscle fibers. Now, this next exercise strategy is not really a hack. It's not groundbreaking, but very, very useful. And that's sprinting, plyometrics, jumping exercises. These are some of the most, some of the best ways to activate motor units, because you're producing so much force. In order to get off the ground, to propel yourself off the ground, okay, you need to produce a lot of force. I think people have misused plyometrics, jumping exercises, and things like that, especially with the advent of CrossFit, doing hundreds of box jumps and hundreds of burpees. To me, that's not intelligent training. In fact, that's not training. That's working out. And don't get me started on that. But just to give you a brief distinction, working out is getting tired. It's doing random exercises. This can be useful for building fitness, but if you want to reach a particular goal, you need to train. You need to have a systematic, consistent way to overload your body. Okay, so by the way, I am a strength coach. I am a personal trainer. I do some online training. I have been doing some virtual training. So if you need help with that, feel free to reach out. But anyway, utilizing different principles is really important. So using sprinting and these explosive power exercises can be very effective. I wouldn't do it more than two times a week, maybe three if you're more of an advanced athlete, but it does take some getting used to, some adaptation, especially in your tendons and things like that. But squat jumps, and again, you don't want to do too many reps. As fatigue increases, your power decreases, and again, we want that power adaptation with jumping exercises. So five reps should be plenty. You can do double leg, single leg. You can use your arms for momentum. You can start at the bottom and jump up. A good progression, I would say, is start with your hands on your hips, squat to the bottom of your squat, hold it 1 second, 2 seconds, and jump. jump as high as you can. Land, stick the landing, okay? You don't want to be falling all over the place. You don't want your knees to cave in. And then repeat, okay? So you want to minimize the momentum that you're using. Now, do that for a couple weeks. And then in that next phase, you can start at the top, squat down fast, and jump up as high as you can. Do that for another couple weeks, and then you can go into continuous jumps. So squat down, jump, right? As soon as you land, jump back up. So these are easy progressions that you can make in building your power and strength in a methodical and safe way, most of all. And again, sprinting is just an expression of power. Again, it also takes a little bit of training and adaptation. I would start, don't start off with 100% sprint. That's how you pull hamstrings, how you pull quads and things like that. Always start off with a thorough warm up, backward running, forward running, hopping, skipping. You want to prep the ankles and your feet. And I will be releasing some videos on foot and ankle strengthening, which is really important and highly underrated. Which brings me to my last hack here. Go barefoot. It seems a little bit esoteric, a little hippie, but the concepts of earthing and grounding, highly beneficial. Anything just for your mental status and your mental state. Being out in the sun, that's just, two birds with one stone. Go walk on some grass, obviously, social distance and whatnot, but the earth, actually, the concept behind these, or the reasoning behind these, is that the earth has a electromagnetic frequency, and our body does as well. Okay, we run on electricity. That's how our muscles contract, and the earth has certain frequencies that are beneficial, essentially. And again, it seems a little hippie, a little bit out there. Many more people that are, more well-versed in that concept than me. But again, at the end of the day, being barefoot will probably benefit you. People are in shoes too much, and shoes are not conducive for foot health in general. I don't advocate for you to go running barefoot right now, for you to switch over to barefoot shoes or those toe shoes and start doing all your exercise that way. But spend a little bit of time barefoot, and just look at your feet. Compare your feet to the foot of a baby. You'll see that their baby's toes, they splay out just like our fingers do. But imagine if you looked at your hand and all your fingers were stuck together and they could not splay out. I mean, you would be pretty freaked out. That's what our toes should have the capability to do. And with using shoes every day, all day, they just get crammed into these pointy boxes with high heels, thick soles, which weaken our feet. A lot of people that have flat feet, they use inserts, but this is just a crutch, okay? So again, I'll probably do a whole nother episode. Actually, I do have a couple episodes coming up with some podiatrists and foot specialists, so really exciting stuff. But in the meantime, spend some time barefoot, even just in your own home. Pay attention to what you're doing with your feet, what your toes are doing, whether you can maintain your arches. And again, I think this is a very highly underutilized tool, especially for athletic performance, if not just health in general. And that leads me to my last tip. The last piece of advice that I have for everyone is to work on your mindset. Now, again, that seems very cliche, but it's so important. Everyone is stressed, but that's life. And right now, stress is at an all-time high, but our mindset can go such a long way. We can choose to be gloomy, to look at the negative side of things. We want to be realistic, but at the same time, we want to make the most out of our situations. Socialize more. Okay, this is going to help you lift your mood. I found that I've been, FaceTiming people, going on Zoom with people way more than before. And it kind of sucks that it took a pandemic to do that. But I think that's had a big impact on my own mindset, my own mind state as well. I'm not going to say stay off social media entirely, but be mindful of what you're looking at on social media. A lot of people talk about the media as being negative, but I think a lot of times that starts with ourselves. We choose what information we accept, and what information manifests into our beliefs and our attitudes. So do some breath work. This goes a long way. Our breath can control our state. And again, when we're in a better state, we can control our mindset. So again, to give you some practical takeaways, try to breathe in for 4 seconds, hold it for 4 seconds, and exhale for 6 seconds. This is not a specific protocol that I use, but it's all about progression. Over time, you should be able to inhale for longer, you should be able to hold your breath for longer, and you should be able to exhale for longer. So personally, I do a 5 second inhale, 10 second hold, and then a 10 to 15 second exhale. This goes a long way. Again, I'll be releasing videos on breathing exercises, but the gist of it is that as we control our breath, this helps us control our central nervous system. So our parasympathetic nervous system, that's our rest and digest system. That's what allows us to be calm, to think clearly. When we're not in that, we're in that sympathetic state, which is fight or flight. And actually, we always have both of them on to differing degrees. But again, there's different times for each one. If you want to exercise, you will be sympathetic. If you're in an argument, you will be sympathetic. But do you always want to be in that state? Probably not, especially if you have performance goals or if you have health goals in general. You want to be in that parasympathetic state, especially when we're going to bed. So you can practice this type of breathing before bed, anytime you have any stressful situation, things like that. So again, control your breath, control your state, control your mindset. That's all I got for you guys today. This was a little bit longer than I wanted it to be. I try to be concise, but hopefully I gave you a lot of bits of information that you can, practical bits of information that you can take away and implement. I'm always here to help, guys. Again, if you think this could help anyone or if this helped you, feel free to leave a review and share it. I will be getting more and more content put out, interviewing more people. I just had two last week that I'm really excited to share with you guys. And again, as this whole pandemic grows, we don't know what the outcome will be. We can't control it, but we can control ourselves. So, you know, I want you to, you know, be mindful of your state, you know, but know that we're all humans. Being stressed isn't a bad thing per se. You know, it is an emotion. We might be fearful. We might be angry at times. You know, honor those emotions, but also know that there's another side to this and know that life goes on and we still need to get things done. So whatever goal you have, again, we're just trying to optimize it and optimize our situation. So again, thanks so much for listening, and we'll be back soon with another episode. Eclectic Athlete Radio. Eclectic Athlete. Eclectic Athlete Radio.